what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic. But melting of permafrost means mass death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia fill leaky boats or trudge overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismal vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century. destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Lindon called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. by mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land, an expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive DeWayse Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear believers, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, wherever you are, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to pose and answer some questions and doubts that comes to us on Islamic beliefs. The question that we are going to talk about today is about Salat or prayer. For that, we have invited a respected scholar from Qom Samir Schools, Sheikh Murtaba Karimi, to help us with the answers to the questions that we pose here. Before I pose the question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh Murtaba to the show and say salam to him. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us, Sheikh, to have you here, and many thanks for accepting the invitation. In our previous show, we have asked a question and posed a doubt, and the respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtaba Karimi, was explaining about the brought up some four answers to the question. And we covered the question that is the question which was mentioned in our previous session on the importance of prayer or salat and the way that it avoids people and works as a deterrent to evil and sinful actions. Now we want to continue the discussion and ask the respected guest of the show to give us a comprehensive answer to finalize the discussion that we started from our last show. Sheikh, just give us a summary of the four points that you mentioned in our previous session on the importance of prayer and how it avoids people and human beings from performing any sinful action. And then let's go to the end and wrap the whole discussion up.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for that. We said that first of all, thinking about the sins is not a sin in and of itself. Second of all, the first explanation of that verse is that it's referring to a person who is careful about all the five daily prayers, and he lives in a society where all the people are the same. So naturally, in such an environment, the possibility for committing sin is much less. And also, we refer to the fact that naturally, when people they are going to say the prayer, they need to pay attention to some conditions, like the fact that the clothes and the place should not have been usurped. And this is another point, I mean, restraining them from committing certain sins. The other explanation was that it's referring to the prayer of, very righteous people with all the conditions. And today, inshallah, I will refer to some of these conditions. The other answer was that it is referring to the time that people, they are saying the prayer. As long as they are saying the prayer, they are not able to commit sins. Also, we said that, it's very logical that if such people did not say the prayer, then they would commit sins more. So although they may commit some sins, but the positive effect of prayer is that they are not going to commit all kinds of sins compared to the people who are not that careful about saying the prayer. And finally, in this part of the answer, I would like to mention the very good explanation of Allama Tabatabai regarding this verse. He says that no doubt prayer, salat, is an action which will restrain people from indecencies and evil action. But the point is that we need to distinguish between two terms, between iqtida, or partial cause, and aliyya tamma, which is the complete and full cause.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say that prayer prevents people from indecencies, it is referring to that partial cause, or iqtida, meaning that prayer has this capacity to do that. It's not the illa tamma, it's not the full cause for preventing people from indecencies and evil actions. So prayer has this capacity, is the partial cause, which means that it has this effect provided that you take into consideration other factors as well. So in and of itself, prayer has this capacity, has this effect, but it would be the full cause and the complete cause if it is not accompanied by, for example, neglecting other obligations. So when we look at the prayer from this perspective, the verse is absolutely true. Prayer has this capacity as a partial cause, not the full cause. And also, it's been mentioned that we know that people have different levels. So we cannot say that, okay, the Holy Prophet is saying the prayer and he's infallible. We say the prayer and we commit sin from time to time. And the Quran says that inna salata tanha 'anil fahsha'i wal munkar. Prayer prevents people from indecencies and evil actions. So it means that my prayer should be like that of the Prophet. This is a wrong comparison. It's true that prayer prevents people from indecencies, but in accordance with the level of the people. For the Prophet, prayer is his prayer is the best example of the prayer. Already he is free from any kind of sin, and so for him prayer is just a means of complete connection to his Lord. Mm-hmm. When we are talking about like great scholar, mystics, again for them I mean, it has another level, and we come to different so many levels. But according to this explanation, for any level, prayer has its own effect. I think I referred to this point in the previous session that whatever spiritual level you are in, prayer has its effect for you.
Very true.
So if you are in the same level and do not say the prayer, then it's very likely for you to commit more indecencies and sins and evil acts. But in the same level, if you are a person of saying the prayer, then at least it will prevent from committing certain sins and indecencies.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you very much. It's a very good point that you mentioned. I want to refer to an article that I have seen some years back, that it was saying that all the believing people, regardless of being a Muslim, actually the rate of, let's say, committing crime is too low among in comparison with others in different societies. So it's not for Islam exactly only. But if you if we add this actual factor of prayer as well in Islam, so as you said, we have to see that if we are really performing prayer in the sense that it was defined, where those, let's say, considering all the, let's say, mustahabbat or recommendations that have been sent, so definitely it works and it will bring a difference, and it adds another factor to the factors that we have seen in the article that says. So in a religion that finds and gives you and defines you this, let's say, rules and regulations, so another factor comes and rationally speaking, it gives another dimension to avoidance of any, let's say, sinful action.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And if you agree, I would like to quickly refer to some of the conditions.
Definitely.
Which are mentioned by a group of the scholars who believe that this prayer is referring to what you mentioned. I mean, a prayer with all the, obligatory and then recommended conditions.
Very true.
So which prayer stops people from indecencies? According to that explanation, it has some conditions. The first point is to know the prayer, how great prayer is. Unfortunately, many of us, we are used to say the prayer, and we neglect the importance of the prayer. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that إِذَا قَامَ الْمُسَلِّ إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ, when you are going to say the prayer, نَزَلَتْ عَلَيْهِ الرَّحْمَةِ مِنْ أَعْنَانِ السَّمَاءِ إِلَى أَعْنَانِ الْأَرْضِ. The mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will come to you from heaven to the earth, and the angel will surround you, and one angel will cry out that if this person who is saying the prayer knew that how great prayer is, then he would not finish his prayer. So this is prayer. But unfortunately, when we say the prayer, we are careless about all these aspects. Imagine that for every prayer, at least we remember this narration. We understand that now we are surrounded by divine angels. So for sure that prayer would have much more positive effects. The next important point is the presence of mind, what is known as hudur al-qalb.
Or presence of heart.
Or presence of heart. It's been mentioned by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt and the Prophet, the fact that if you're going to have a fruitful prayer, then you are required to have hudur al-qalb, the presence of heart and mind. The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, "To prayer with, attention is much better than, keeping a night vigil, but with ignorance and negligence." And I mean, it's a long discussion. There are some ways recommended by the scholars of ethics and spirituality how we are able to acquire this feature. So if you are going to have a prayer, to say a prayer which is going to have this effect of preventing from indecencies and evil actions, we need to find the ways to acquire Hudur al-Qalb and, I mean, develop it day by day. The next point, the next condition is about, your, let's say, physical appearance at the time of the prayer. We are highly recommended to choose our best clothes at the time of the prayer, to use perfume, to be, good looking. So, but unfortunately, the majority of us, we are not such that. Imagine that for every prayer, we go to the closet and choose the best clothes and then use perfume as if we are going to meet the president of the country. So for sure, gradually speaking, this prayer would have much more positive effects on us. But we are not doing that. Even, brushing the teeth has been mentioned as one of the etiquette of the prayer. I mean, before any prayer, just go and brush your teeth. So these are some of the physical, etiquette of the prayer that we also need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Saying the prayer in congregation is another important point. Unfortunately, we do not have time to mention all the details and narrations about that. So if you are going to have a prayer with utmost good results, one of the ways is to say the prayer in congregation, taking care of the time of the prayer. I mean, there are very powerful narrations about the importance of saying the prayer on time, at the recommended time. And some great statements by, great mystics. Mm-hmm. It's a very famous story about late Sayyid Ali Aqa Qazi that try to say your prayers on time. If you do that and you do not reach high spiritual level, then curse me.
Yeah.
And it's been mentioned that it was asked from Ayatollah Bahjat that does Sayyid Ali Al-Qadi refer to a prayer with presence of heart? And he said that no. I mean, the
just
very...
Just performing it on time.
On time. Right. It means that you are careful about your prayer.
Yeah.
And gradually speaking, it will bring about many good results. So to wrap up the discussion, we refer to a couple of points. But maybe 2 points are the main ones. First of all, the prayer of each person will have a good result.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it would make them close to being infallible. And for some people, it will cause them to commit less sins.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, if we are going to our prayer to have the most effects, then we need to pay attention to the conditions, some of which were mentioned today, like presence of heart, like knowing the prayer and etiquette of the prayer, saying the prayer in congregation and on time.
And I think it's good to add one more aspect to that.
Sure.
When the person prays, but the outcome of it is something exactly against whatever he does. Like, for example, Shemr was famous for his prayers. But what makes him to kill the imam of his time? It is because that he was wrong in a sense, in the base
mm-hmm.
of whatever he had in,
mind. Point.
So this this sort of prayer also acts exactly against whatever the person
mm-hmm.
is going for. Many thanks, Sheikh Murtada Karimi.
My pleasure.
And you, respected listeners, for staying tuned and listening to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لعلي وحسين وحسن
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade, and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and secondhand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember actually was back in the 1970s, when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over about 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carried on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that. So that's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut. But unfortunately, when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite Trade Union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite Union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately, the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government's imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claim the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October, from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least for the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
After a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for two decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called War on Terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. It was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decade, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
we can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment, and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli prime minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE. They don't care about the people of Palestine. And they don't care about the Arab. They certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as the root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. During his high court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, it will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances, because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot. They just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction, because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over, whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, there were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the U.K. or other parts of the world may now be brought to the U.S. for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the U.S. is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom.
Minutes.
1916, once Britain's Prime Minister, then the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, promised Palestine to the Jewish community in Britain. Then, on November 2, 1917, he made it official in the form of a letter addressed to the leader of the Jewish community and a member of the Zionist movement in Britain, Walter Rothschild. At the time, Britain was not even in control of Palestine, as it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Either way, Palestine was never Balfour's to transfer so casually to anyone else. The letter, known as the Balfour Declaration, marked the beginning of the occupation of Palestine.
And a group of Zionists met in London in 1917 on July the 17th to draft the formula for a declaration to be made by the British government that would, in fact, provide the underpinnings and the justification for Jewish immigration to Palestine and the creation of a national homeland. And so on July 17th, the Zionist organization completed work that it had been working on for a long time and drafted a declaration which was to be forwarded on to the British government. The British government then spent 4 or 5 months debating the formula for the declaration, slightly adjusted it, and issued it at the beginning of November in 1917.
When the intentions of the British and their rapport with the Zionists became too apparent, Palestinians started to protest, a kind that has never ceased, over a century later. The reason is, of course, too apparent, since the horrific consequences of British colonialism and the eventual complete Zionist takeover of Palestine are still felt after all these years. Paltry attempts to pacify Palestinian anger were to no avail, especially after the League of Nations Council in July 1922 approved the terms of the British mandate for Palestine. It came without consulting the Palestinians, who would disappear from the British and international radar, only to reappear as negligible rioters, troublemakers, and obstacles to the joint British-Zionist colonial concoctions. Despite occasional assurances, the British intention of ensuring the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state in Palestine was becoming clearer with time. The Balfour Declaration was hardly an aberration, but had indeed set the stage for the full-scale ethnic cleansing that followed decades later.
We are here in the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. We come here every week and to say no to the occupation, no to apartheid, no to ethnic cleansing. The Israeli government is planning to deport the indigenous people, Palestinian people, from their home in order to evacuate it for settlers, for Jewish settlers, for colonialists.
After World War II, the UK appeared as less influential in the international arena compared to what it used to be. However, it continued to support Israel in every possible way. In November 1967, after the Six-Day War, Britain co-authored the UN Resolution 242, which could have led to a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, it did very little to insist on its implementation as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. While many might argue that Britain has been more vocal towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians, London has taken no real action to condemn Israel for the crimes it commits in the occupied territories. For example, Britain could have issued a symbolic apology in 2017 on the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. It could have been a moment of reckoning for Britain, but it was not. Instead, the government of then Prime Minister Theresa May celebrated the occasion with Israeli authorities. In the meantime, the British government continues to advocate for the so-called two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But in reality, it's only protecting the interests of the Israelis.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, 3 years ago, on the 9th of November 2011, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Richmondshire, then Foreign Secretary, told this House, and I quote, "The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for United Nations membership, including statehood." And he added, and again I quote, "We reserve the right, we the United Kingdom, reserve the right to recognize a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace. Mr. Deputy Speaker, that moment is now. I urge honourable members on all sides to support this amendment.
What we want is to see an Israel that is at peace with its neighbours, and I should remind you that the policy of our government is for a two-state solution, which is what we want to achieve and hope to help to bring about in a modest and humble way.
In fact, every time Palestine was getting close to claiming its rights, the UK came forward and stalled the process. When asked for clarification on the question of Palestinian statehood, then UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab sent a letter to the Balfour Project reiterating an old position. The British government will recognize a Palestinian state at a time when it best serves the objective of peace.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting leaders on all sides in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, President Abbas, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Ashkenazi. And look, I'm here because we are a strong friend of Israel, but we also feel very strongly that we want to see a peaceful two-state solution. We've got the ceasefire. The question is now how we can build on that, bed that in, avoid any further escalations, and try and find a track towards a two-state solution.
In just another example, back in April 2021, UK opposed the ICC investigation, saying it does not accept that the ICC has jurisdiction in this instance, partly since Palestine is not a sovereign state. Needless to say, the two-state idea is completely rejected by Palestinians, since they know all too well that none of the Western countries that talk about such a solution are on their side. That said, the resistance movement insists, as the only viable solution, on a public referendum participated in only by those who have roots in the land. Britain still talks about the so-called solution, but in reality, Israel has already killed the idea, trying to become a full-blown apartheid regime with international blessing. The support that Israel gets from Britain is not limited to these policies. In December 2020, Britain and Israel signed a military cooperation agreement.
Battle-tested on civilian populations around the world. Today, specifically, a Stop Arming Israel Day, because our government licenses weapons to a regime which is occupying a people and is using those weapons against the people, as we've seen over the last year, against ordinary people marching for freedom in Gaza.
There are also huge arms deals between the two as well. The UK has bought £46 million worth of military equipment from Israeli arms firm Elbit in the past 4 years. British soldiers have also been stationed in Israel since day one of the occupation. They give the Israelis military advice and training. The ties between Britain and Israel are so tight that the UK can never have an impartial stance when it comes to the Palestine issue, no matter who occupies the number 10 in Downing Street. Yet this unholy alliance has been at the expense of the Palestinian people, who have been geographically fragmented between refugee camps, in the diaspora, militarily occupied, and treated as second-class citizens in a land their ancestors dwelt since time immemorial.
IRIB English Radio.